Welcome to the Bardcast. It's Shakespeare, you dick. We are your hosts. I am Lisa Ann Goldsmith.
And I am Owen Thompson. And today we're discussing race in Shakespeare, a somewhat sensitive topic. And so we are happy to say that for the very first time, we will be joined by a guest. Lisa Ann, would you like to tell our listeners who our guest is today?
Yeah, we're super excited. Our guest today will be Alvin Keith, and we'll tell you a little bit more about him when he comes on. But he is a classically trained Broadway film and television actor, and he is African-American. And we thought that it would make much more sense for us as just two white kids, albeit both of us are Jewish in our heritage, to have an actor of color that we love and respect, because we're sure that his feelings on race in Shakespeare are going to be different somewhat than ours.
Yes, his perspective is invaluable. I really think it's going to add to this conversation in a major way.
Right. And not just for the purposes of our discussion, but we also think that how he feels about things and what he says will be invaluable to our listeners.
And he's just awesome.
And he's just fucking awesome. In fact, I did a play with him, but I'll tell you guys about that later. But we wanted to give you a little bit of background about how Elizabethans looked at people of other races or religions. In fact, they were leery and suspicious of any foreigners, and they treated all strangers as suspect. I mean, that was partly due to their lack of understanding and their knowledge of other cultures, but the people of England at that time believed themselves to be far superior, and they treated others with indignity, sometimes pity. They would say things like, pride is the disease of the Spaniard, or the Italian is a cunning, proud fellow, or the Frenchman, for the most part, loves none but himself and his pleasures, and the Danes are the most gross and senseless, proud dolts. The government at that time.
I just love the word dolt.
It is a good word. Dolt 45. Never mind. The government at that time was concerned with the infiltration of Catholicism, and at one point had any English person that was studying in a Catholic country return to England so as not to be converted. The threat of foreigners taking over jobs held by Englishmen was also a reason for conflict. Trade imbalance and the high rate of unemployment during the 16th century made the English cautious and suspicious of others. Turkish armies invading Eastern Europe weighed very heavily on the rest of Europe. They were viewed as an enemy of the people and of their faith. They were seen as cruel, labeled as stubborn and barbaric. In fact, Othello uses the word Turk to denote a liar who is evil and untrustworthy, which is really interesting. People of color from Africa brought to England against their will emerged as slaves and servants. And the English were intrigued that their black skin could not be washed off. Black was denoted to be evil and ugly, since the Elizabethans believed that outward appearances reflected inner reality, which we talked a little bit about when we were talking about the difference between the hidden Catholicism and Protestantism in Shakespeare's plays earlier.
Lots of prejudice against religion and race in Elizabethan England, but it's important to say that using a word like racism, particularly when you're talking about Shakespeare, is dicey at best, because the term didn't exist then. I mean, remember, there's no what we would call tourism at the time, right? People are not just traveling, unless you're very, very rich, you're not traveling for pleasure in between these two countries. So foreigners were feared, as Lisa Ann has just said, and suspected. Also, it's important to remember, in terms of Jews, Shakespeare would almost certainly have never met an actually openly practicing Jew. This is largely because in 1290, all Jews were kicked out of England by Edward I. Just kicked out. No more Jews in England. Now, it is true that a handful remained.
Mostly
Portuguese Jews, and some of them had actually converted. Some of them pretended to have converted. It's also important to remember that the Spanish Inquisition was still going on at this time, right? And also that the Moors, quote unquote, the Muslim armies had taken over, had conquered Iberia, both Portugal and Spain, for centuries, and had only recently been driven out. So there was a lot of intermarrying in those years, and a lot of a lot of Moors and Jews supposedly converted to Christianity, but they were suspected of being false, of pretending. So the Jews who were considered to be fake Christians, as it were called Moranos, and Moors who were considered to be fake Christians were Moriscos. So there were several, of the Jews who remained in England, some were probably secretly practicing Jews, but if Shakespeare ever met any, it's unlikely that he would have been aware.
Although we think that Shakespeare was a secretly practicing Catholic, so he would have understood.
Well, I mean, it's certainly possible that he was a secretly practicing Catholic. But the difference between Judaism and Catholicism in terms of how an Elizabethan would have thought of them would have been tremendous. There were all sorts of myths about Jews' physicality being different from a Christian's.
Big hooked nose, horns.
Supposedly that they smelled different. There was a persistent myth that Jewish men menstruated. And of course, there was a myth that went on and on for centuries about how Jews like to abduct Christian children and murder them and use their blood in secret Jewish rituals. I mean, horrible stuff.
But it was said that they then, and this is so fucking stupid, it was said that they would circumcise them first and then murder them.
Right, right.
That doesn't even make any sense.
It doesn't make it. Well, you know, prejudice doesn't make sense. That's kind of the point of prejudice. Awful. Yeah. There was a famous case involving a Jew in Shakespeare's time, Dr. Rodrigo Lopez.
That's right. Dr. Lopez he served as physician in chief to Queen Elizabeth I from 1581 until his death by execution, having been found guilty of plotting to poison her. He is the only royal doctor in English history to have been executed and may, in fact, have inspired the character of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice, which was written within 4 years of his death.
It is certainly possible.
Yeah.
He was a Portuguese Jew. He had converted. But he was in fact receiving letters from the King of Spain, and it is possible that he had agreed to try to assassinate Elizabeth, but it was never proved. And Elizabeth was very hesitant to have him killed, but finally, at the persistence of one of her favorites, the Earl of Essex, he was finally executed in the most horrifying manner possible. He was hanged, drawn, and quartered, and we've talked about that particular death on other podcasts. But some people, including Stephen Greenblatt, who wrote the brilliant book Will in the World, hypothesized that Shakespeare indeed may have witnessed that execution, and that that could have been, the timing certainly makes it possible that it could have been at least a partial inspiration for The Merchant of Venice.
Yeah, that would make sense. You know, I mean, Elizabeth waited weeks before she agreed to execute him. And then 10 years later, the Spanish government made a statement in fact saying that he was innocent.
He certainly got railroaded one way or the other, I think it's fair to say. Some people actually have disputed recently whether or not the general public knew about his Jewishness. I actually, a few years ago, when I was in grad school, I wrote a paper about this, and I got in a little bit of trouble with some people who read the paper, who claimed that recent scholarship had said that the reason he was derided by the public was for his Portuguese-ness rather than his Jewishness, because there's very little record there's very little public record of him being a Jew.
Yeah.
So it's, it, you know, these things are, it, there's never a slam dunk with these things, but it's certainly a fascinating case.
It is. I wanted to correct myself. The Queen actually waited over 3 months before signing the death warrant.
Mm. It was that pesky Essex.
Yeah. And actually all of his property was forfeited when he was executed. But his widow, Sarah, petitioned the Queen to keep his estate, and the only thing the Queen kept was a ring that she had given to Lopez's daughter, and gave everything else back to Sarah. So that says something to me about whether or not Elizabeth really thought he was guilty.
Yeah, there's no way of proving it, but it certainly, her actions would indicate that she didn't think that he was guilty, but that she gave in to Essex after all.
But Jews weren't the only ones that did not have a good name in England at the time.
No, certainly not. And so the term Moor is thrown around a lot, and certainly the most famous person of color in the Shakespeare canon is Othello, and in the title, of course, that play is Othello, the Moor of Venice. So Moor basically means like it doesn't necessarily mean what we would think of as somebody who was African American or African. It's more of a Northern Africa, like from the Islamic world kind of thing. But
Right.
certainly the descriptions of Othello in that play indicate that he's more from Central Africa, or descended from people who are from Central Africa. And there are only three African characters in Shakespeare.
That's right, Othello, the Prince of Morocco, and Aaron the Moor.
Right. Aaron the Moor, one of the most horrifying villains in all of Shakespeare.
Yeah, he's pretty bad.
Although that play is such, I mean, it's a very crude play by Shakespeare's later standards.
Right. The only other place it's Moors are well, a place that Moors are mentioned is in Act 5, Scene 2 of Love's Labour's Lost, and the stage direction is "Enter the Blackamoors with music."
Yeah,
But
but
that would have
that's
been
more.
English minstrels in
I was going to
blackface.
say that's a
Yeah.
minstrel show.
Yeah.
That's not they're not meant to be actual,
That's right.
people
Well,
of
they never
color.
would have been. I mean, it's not like there were any black performers who were being barred from
Well,
royal
no, but I
aristocratic
mean,
houses to play roles in Shakespeare because
of
they were
course not.
black.
But I mean, but Othello is meant to be a person of color.
Yeah.
Even if he's played in blackface, he's still, he's not a white person. In Love's Labour's Lost, those people are white people pretending, it's a minstrel show.
That's right.
But again, it's important to remember how that there wouldn't be, have been too many people of color that Shakespeare would have, or anybody in Elizabethan society would have necessarily run into. And again, we get back to the Spanish Inquisition and the things that went on in Iberia in medieval and early modern times. As I said before, the forces of Islam had conquered both Portugal and Spain and ruled there for many, many years until they were finally thrown out. In order to root out Jews from in Portugal and Spain, the Spanish Inquisition was instituted in 1478. And by who? By that cute couple, Ferdinand and Isabella.
Oh, those doll faces.
The same ones that bankrolled Columbus and his voyage across the sea. And we know we haven't been told the whole story in school growing up about Columbus, but Ferdinand and Isabella, they started the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah.
The just a delight. So one other thing, just an interesting factoid about the results of the Spanish Inquisition and Pete and Muranos and Moriscos and all of that. There was so much intermarriage in the centuries of the Spanish conquest that this is where the term blue blood comes from for nobility. Blue blood in Spanish is sangre azul. And the reason for this is like there were families that would either pretend or would claim that they had never intermarried with anyone from another race, and therefore their blood was pure. But and to demonstrate that, they were so white that if you look on their arms, you could see their blue veins. So that's where the term blue blood comes from. So it actually has a racist origin.
Yeah, it sure does. And I think we should also talk about some of the references to Jews and African Americans in Shakespeare. They're generally used as a denigration. I mean, in A Midsummer Night's Dream, when Lysander is trying to get rid of Hermia, he calls her "you Ethiope."
And Ethiope is a common word in Shakespeare
Sure is.
for black. It occurs in, I think it's 10 different plays, including Midsummer Night's Dream. The word Jew, ironically, only appears in 7 plays, although, of course, it appears quite a lot in one of them in particular.
But
And it's
also in a denigration.
Yeah, it's and it's almost always used as a sort of a casual denigration, like when Benedict says of Beatrice, "If I do not love her, I am a Jew," right? Or Falstaff, pretending to be honest, saying, "Or else I am a Jew, an Hebrew Jew." So it's just a casual slur. And again, it's so odd because there were some Jews, but not too many. So it's interesting how the idea of Jewishness became such a thing in Shakespeare's time.
Well, I mean, they were thrown out and then they weren't officially allowed back into England until 1655.
Right. That's exactly right.
So they weren't supposed to be there.
Right. Well, and you know, obviously, if there's if you know your history in Shakespeare's time, and you know that an entire people have been expelled from your kingdom a few hundred years earlier, you're not necessarily going to think the best of them.
No. And if they are around, they're not going to let you know.
No, of course not, because it's as much as, and certainly after what happened to Dr. Lopez, I mean, imagine if you were a Jew in London and you saw that happen. Well, you were already playing it pretty safe. But after that, Jesus.
Right. And in fact, he even on his deathbed, he said.
Yeah, he said, I love the Queen as much as I love Jesus Christ.
That's right.
And he said that in public, and people laughed at him because they thought since he was a Jew, that meant that he hated the Queen because he actually hated Jesus Christ.
Which is ridiculous.
Yes. Well, it was all and also he's being torn in pieces. Well, I mean, literally torn in pieces while he's saying that. So, you know, fuck you for laughing at him.
Yeah. So on that note, as we said earlier, we wanted to get another point of view on this very timely, important, and frankly, often inflammatory topic.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, we would love to welcome a wonderful actor and dear friend, Alvin Keith, to the podcast. Alvin is an Alabama Shakespeare MFA classically trained actor who has been on Broadway and has tons of other theater, film, and television credits. In fact, Alvin and I met doing the play Windfall, which was the premiere of a new black comedy directed by Seinfeld's Jason Alexander at Arkansas Rep in 2016, which is just an insane and wonderful experience. But also, Owen and I are super thrilled that he has been gracing us with his immeasurable talent for our Shakespeare Sundays so far this year during the pandemic, which is, we told you guys about, we read Shakespeare plays every other Sunday. So Alvin, my darling, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to the podcast. Yes, welcome to It's Shakespeare, you dick.
Howdy, you two. Howdy, everybody. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me and for having me here. I'm excited.
Oh, my God. We love you and we respect you. And, we were talking about this topic and really Owen was like, we should have a guest and it should be Alvin. And I was like, oh, my God. Yes, we should.
Yeah, we've been talking about the possibility of having a guest for a long time. We haven't done it so far, but when we were talking about the run up to this particular episode, I thought, well, we need another perspective. It can't be just Lisa Ann and I on this.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we immediately thought of you.
So you're our first guest, Alan.
Yay.
All right, I'm the first guest. Yes.
You are number one, baby.
Uh-oh.
So
awesome.
So let's start this conversation, I think, with a really basic question, but one that was certainly foremost on our minds. So we would like to know that as an actor of color trained in Shakespeare, what has been your experience as far as casting? And has that changed much throughout the years of your career?
My experience with casting in classical roles, well, Shakespeare specifically, has been... it hasn't been all that diverse, if I can say.
No, that's exactly what we want to know.
No, I mean, there are certain roles I think that are just put aside for people of color or African Americans in the canon, other than Othello and other than Aaron and Titus Andronicus. And those roles are, you know, things like Oberon, Yeah, if you
make
a type screen, then, you know, the person of color can be Oberon, you know, and...
Caliban.
Caliban.
Definitely Caliban.
Prince of Morocco.
But those are, like, the Prince of Morocco, at least that kind of, like, makes sense a little bit. You know what I mean? Othello even makes sense a bit. But when it comes to something like, Henry V, mm-hmm. you know, like... I don't get offers for Henry V,
right.
you know.
Right. So if it's the king of the fairies, that's one thing. But if it's an actual king of England, not so much.
Absolutely not. No, no. And also, too, it's very interesting when it comes to playing like the lovers, even. I guess maybe back in the 90s, like I like to say it was when Wilson and was it Bernstein were going back and forth with their kind of... they're duels about non-traditional casting and colorblind casting and that whole bit. I believe that was the 90s or what have you. What came out of that, or at least I was in graduate school at the time, and what came out of that was, like you said, Owen, we couldn't be the king of England. We couldn't even be the prince, you know, of England, but we could play Lysander. We could, you know, it was like that. And then that was in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a fantasy and a fairy tale. So I guess to kind of go back and answer the question, my experience with casting and Shakespeare has been, unless it's been Othello or the Prince of Morocco or what have you, it's the plays that are most fantastical that that I've been cast in, or that I really get offers, or more importantly, auditions.
Right.
Right. And just to the tail end of that question, do you find that there's been any shift in that for the better or worse, or none at all in like in present times?
Not really. And the reason I say that is because, you know, one African-American or one person of color, you know, playing, playing one of the great roles once a year or once every 3 years, to me doesn't
move the needle. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't move the needle. And if that person is famous already, and if that person is from England already, then it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't move the needle. So to be honest, no, I don't really see that. No, I don't see any movement there really.
Right. And it doesn't really count when you have an African-American actor playing Julius Caesar specifically because you want him to be thought of as Barack Obama.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which is another, thank you. That's another great point, Lisa, when it comes to, you know, the interpretations or whatever, you know, someone wants to put onto the play, then perhaps, you know, African-Americans will get cast. You know, well, we all know the Romeo and Juliet, right? You know, the Capulets, you know, are going to be white, and the Montagues are going to be black. And so, you know.
Yeah, they did that in that Orlando Bloom Condoleur Shod production from about 4 or 5 years ago. I think it was the other way around. But yeah, like one family was white and one family was black. That's not colorblind cast. I mean, to me, it's like not, if you want to make a parable or a comparison between Barack Obama and Julius Caesar, so you cast a black actor as Caesar, to me that's it may be valid, but it's not colorblind.
Not at all.
Jinx.
So that brings me to the story. So my dear friend Randy Kovitz, a wonderful actor and director, went to CMU, and he had a friend, Jim Craven, who he says he was the first black actor that worked at Alabama Shakes, and this was 1977 or 1978, and he was playing Laertes in Hamlet. And after opening night, the reaction that the theater got from him, you know, as Laertes hugging, kissing his sister Ophelia, who was played by a white actress, was so extreme that they bought him out of his contract and got him out of the state.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a friend of his who was directing.
When was this?
1977, 78, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I believe that wholeheartedly. I believe it wholeheartedly because things like that happened in the late 90s as well. Not as extreme, but I will tell you that, let's just say, the people of Alabama, some people in Alabama did express their... their views about about a black man and a white girl being on stage, loving, being in love.
I'm sure. Well, I mean, Alvin, when you and I were in Little Rock, Arkansas in 2016, driving the back roads, we looked at each other in the car and said, this is probably not a good idea because we're a black man and a Jewess. And we're like, in the back woods of Arkansas.
Isn't that ironic? I'm assuming, Alvin, that the people that in Alabama that had that adverse reaction were patrons, right? People who were used to seeing Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
So they would have no problem, I'm assuming, attending a production of Othello in which a black man is married and in love with a white woman, but he ends up killing her, so it's okay.
Absolutely.
Well, they wouldn't like it, but they'd come see it.
Well, but they know what it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. They already know what the story is. And, you know, at the end of the day, Othello gets it. So,
right. You know, right. God, I hate to think of them sitting there rooting for Iago.
Well, yeah.
God.
Well, I will tell you, without getting people in trouble or anything like that, I did experience something like that in Alabama as well. Because one thing I will say about the theater, it's at least when it came to the graduate work, because the graduate students were a part of the main company. And so we were in all of the repertory shows, but we also did our own separate shows as graduate students that would still be performed with the same patrons on the same stages and what have you. And I will say that with the graduate students in the graduate program, they try to push the envelope a little, just because there were only 8 of us per class. And in one of our shows that we did get some letters. Let's just say that I was the romantic guy and yeah. They got some.
Do you mind telling us what the show was?
What was that show? I believe it was Taming of the Shrew.
Oh boy. Wait, so you were Petruchio?
No, Lucentio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. As I thought, maybe they were reacting to the spectacle of somebody, you know, physically abusing a woman. But it wasn't even that.
No. It was just love and kiss and, you know,
Yep.
Don't you touch those white women, you know.
That's just amazing to me. I mean, and I'm sure Owen can understand, like being a New Yorker, I mean, we've certainly seen, you know, incidents of racism, but never anything like that. That just blows my mind.
No, although I mean, this is not a Shakespeare thing at all, but when I was considerably younger, I did 2 productions of Master Harold and the Boys when I was in my 20s. And boy, oh boy, the things that I learned. It was very, very, very instructive to do that particular play, which for those who don't know is a play about a white kid in South Africa and his 2 basically surrogate fathers who are black servants of his family in a tea house. It's an amazing play, but you know, we bonded. I love those guys that were in that show, and we would go out and, you know, we almost got thrown in jail in Poughkeepsie one night for trying to go into a club, seriously. And it was completely because they were black. I mean, it was so eye-opening to me and horrifying.
So fucked up.
Yeah, it was, I mean, unbelievable. But so I
that
do.
That play is by Athol Fugard, if anybody wants to look it up.
Yeah,
by
it's
the
a
way.
Brilliant.
And the young boy, the young white boy is Master Harold.
Yes.
By the way.
Master Harold. Yes.
He's yes. Master Harold.
Yes, who the boys are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a beautiful play.
It's a great play.
Yeah. Anyway, so we had another question, but I think it's been answered about, I mean, but I don't know. Do you find that directors that you work for are cool with colorblind casting or resistant to it? Or what would you say?
I'm trying to think if, like, which plays that I've done that have actually really been colorblind. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I will say one who was fantastic about it was Joe Dowling. Joe Dowling was absolutely fantastic about colorblind casting, and I love him. It was he was the artistic director of the Guthrie Theater in the 90s and early 2000s. And my first... Well, my second job out of graduate school was A Midsummer Night's Dream. And I played Lysander for Joe Dowling. And that cast was truly multicultural, ethnic, the whole bit. So he was very good about that.
So I actually have a question for you about you playing Lysander, because, you know, Lysander at one point calls Hermia an Ethiope and says, out, tawny Tartar. So what was that like for you? Like, how do you feel saying those words as that character?
What do you mean saying those words?
So calling Alvin, you're a bitch.
You know, hey, what's the first thing you do when you get a Shakespeare play, when you're, you know, when you're going to do a Shakespeare play? You start cutting it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never heard that. I've never said, out you Ethiop.
Wow.
Never said it.
So that's interesting. So on that note, do you think that Shakespeare was racist or anti-Semitic?
You know, that's right. That is like the really big question. When I was in graduate school, I was convinced that he was. I was also in a whole nother space, being in Montgomery, Alabama, right, and the only Black man of, you know, for 3 years in graduate school. So my whole
sure
on things was extremely specific and tight. When I look at it now, when I go and look back now, I wouldn't, like you said, they didn't have a term for racism. So I wouldn't necessarily say that Shakespeare was racist, you know, for Elizabethan times. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I think he definitely did have an opinion about others. I think that he had an opinion about faraway and exotic, you know, lands. And that just so happens to be, you know, places like Morocco, places like, you know, Northern Africa, where the Moors are from, or what have you. So I guess in short, I don't think he was racist, but I think that he definitely had an opinion, and he knew that the people had an opinion. Yeah. Of
mm-hmm. people. And he's got, and obviously he's a commercial writer, so obviously he's going to want to please his audience, first and foremost.
Right, and absolutely. He is a product of his times, you know?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he wrote for the people.
Right.
When people showed up on the stage, right, the characters showed up on the stage, the people knew who they were.
The thing that always interests me that way, and I totally agree with what you're saying, but what both of you were saying, person of his time, obviously, you know, not there is no term for racism then, et cetera, but there definitely is a portrayal of the other, who, however that manifests itself, that is different from his portrayal of white, Christian, English or European folk.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And yet, the genius in Shakespeare, to me, it's, if you look at a character like Shylock, That character could easily have been just a two-dimensional Jewish devil kind of character, much like Barabbas in The Jew
right.
of Malta,
which I was just
the way
say
that Christopher Marlowe treated it. And yet, that play is so complicated because even though Shylock is the bad guy and what he wants is, you know, unspeakable, but Shakespeare humanizes that character to such a degree that we end up feeling horrible when he loses. And no one is more human than Othello.
True.
I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it doesn't. He's not the brightest bulb in the drawer, but he's a really good-hearted person, and filled with nobility. So you know, I mean, it makes this question really complicated, I think.
Well, and it's also, Owen, like you're saying, right? It's also what kind of makes Shakespeare brilliant, because he did that. That's what he did with all of his plays, really, right? Mm. Because they were all sourced, and he just made them better. And one of the ways he made them better was by turning the characters, by making the characters, you know, three-dimensional, which before, I don't even know if people were writing, you know what I'm saying, that way. The characters were more two-dimensional, just period.
Right. Well, although, like in the earlier plays, like Titus Andronicus, I don't really.
I don't
feel bad for Aaron the Moor at any point.
I mean, the difference between Aaron the Moor and Othello, you know, is night and day.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, Titus Andronicus is a play that Shakespeare A did not write by himself, and B he wrote at the very beginning of his career when he was finding his legs, and he wrote Othello at the very height of his tremendous powers. So there's a chasm between those two plays.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So have you, would you say that you have experienced any kind of discrimination as an actor of color in the casting, rehearsal, and or performance process of any play, but specifically Shakespeare plays?
Well, yeah, of course. See, that's another one where you're like, at one particular time in my life, very early on, I would have thought that, you know, most things were just like racist, or most things were, you know what I mean? Anytime there was any kind of question or problem about race or that came up early on in my career, I would have thought that, like, these people are racist. They don't understand. Why do they want to cut Ethiopia? You know.
Are you saying you're more chill in your old age, Alvin? Is that what you're saying? Like Owen and I?
I think so. I think I'm a little more chill, but also I think that in my older age, directors have more respect for my experience.
Definitely.
As well. And so my voice in the rehearsal hall now is very different, or the way that my voice is heard in the rehearsal hall now is very different than it was, you know, 20 years ago, or even 15 years ago, when I first, you know, started and was doing these Shakespeare plays professionally, you know. So trying to think if there was anyone that, like, actual real discrimination. Yeah, no, I'll get back to you on that.
Yeah, I mean, we've all, you know, I'm sure all three of us have experienced some asshole or another during a rehearsal period or performance period. But we're just curious if it's like, I mean, like, I've certainly experienced shitty treatment from male actors that I thought were incredibly misogynistic.
Absolutely. You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, so, and that's, I really want to be careful with that. You know what I mean? With, like, the whole idea of, like, saying that people were being, just, you know, it's 2020 and I want to be, like, really, you know, specific, and I want to be true to the moments that have happened, but I want to, you know, call things for what they are with my eyes now. I have to say, more often than not, though, the directors that I've worked with have actually been quite conscious about race. I think, because also they knew what they were getting into when they were casting it. You know what I mean? So I think they've been, more often than not, yes, they've been pretty conscious. I think, yeah, I'll leave it there.
I would like to think that we as artists are, you know, certainly more woke than the average folk.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I'm sorry, Lisa, but here's the thing, right? The director can be conscious, right? And the director can have all the greatest intentions in the world. But if the director is directing a play in a particular place, there's only so much that director can do, because the director is not from there.
Right.
You know, the director is coming from New York, or the director is coming from, you know, some big city, you know, somewhere. But you're doing the play in a town or in a state that isn't so woke. Right. And so sometimes the director is actually kind of shackled, is actually kind of, you know, but constrained. Do you know what I mean?
I feel that, because as a director working, you know, we have, especially a New York City director, we all kind of live in our bubbles
Yeah,
I kind of tend to, I mean, I reflexively think of everyone in theater being progressive and being on the same page about colorblind casting and that sort of thing. But you're right. I mean, if you're not working in New York, it's going to be a very different experience. And I'm not necessarily even saying necessarily a bad one, but it'll be different because Alabama is not New York, for instance.
Not at all. And it's the people in Alabama that are paying, you know, for the lights to be on.
Exactly. I'm not saying anything against Alabama. I'm just saying that it's, and I'm just picking it because we were talking about Alabama, but you know.
Well, you could say Arkansas because we were there in 2016 and had that.
I mean, I directed a play in Wisconsin earlier this year before everything got locked down, and it's a very different feeling there too.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, sometimes you know you can't curse. You know, you can't. I mean, many different things. You know,
for instance. At the end of the particular play that I directed in Wisconsin, there's a scene where, with two guys where they may or may not be a couple. We are not really sure. And there had been a production of this play at Milwaukee Rep a couple of years ago. I wasn't at Milwaukee Rep. I was elsewhere. And at the end of the play, the two actors had a kiss. And I was warned by the people that hired me when I got there. It's not a good idea to end the play that way if you're thinking about doing that. And I actually wasn't thinking about doing that because I wanted the ambiguity to still be there. But I was like, oh, okay. And that's just an illustration. I was, you know, I was basically told that was a choice that I couldn't make as a director.
Yeah.
And it
I've been in that situation. You know,
yeah. So I get it. I totally get that. Well, so on a happier topic. What are some of your favorite Shakespeare roles that you've played, and what are some that you really want to play?
Now, all that said, we were talking about A Midsummer Night's Dream, but I have to tell you, I love King Oberon. I love him. I love him. I love him so much. It's probably my most fun and probably favorite Shakespeare role. I played Oberon like two or three times now, and I always find new things with it. And I always think that it's great to be the king, of course.
Right? Especially a magic king.
Right.
But if you're a magic king, if you can do magic, that's the king of all kings.
But come on, Alvin, you're waiting for me as your Titania. I know that's true.
Absolutely. Lisa Ann, you know, we would kill it.
We would kill it. I mean, when I played it, I had an awful Oberon, so I would give anything to do it with you.
Yes, no, I would love. We've talked about that for years now.
We have.
Yes. We got a chance to at least read it.
That's right. That was
right.
We got a
that's
chance
right,
to read
for one of our Shakespeare Sundays, and it was a joy.
So much. I'm just thinking about that opening scene with Oberon and Titania. Yes, absolutely. Let me see. What else would I look? Okay, so I would love, well, I'm too old for it now, but I would have loved to have played Henry V. I would have loved to have played Henry V. And I would have loved to have played Hal.
Oh, I would have loved to have played Hal.
Yeah, I would have loved to have played Hal. Now the looking forward, I would love to play Richard the Second.
Richard the Second. Why Richard the Second?
I love language. One of the things I love the most about Shakespeare is the language. And I feel so just like good. And it makes me feel good to know that I can speak those words and I can speak the poetry and I can make it mean something to someone else that's watching. And I just think that Richard II is so just tragic and his poetry is so great. And I'm usually I play strong characters, you know, and Richard II is just like not that, you know?
No, he's not.
No.
Yeah, he's not that. He's just... Yeah, so that's one I would love.
I agree with you about that play. I think the language in that play is some of Shakespeare's most unbelievable poetry. And I just found one of my favorite lines in all of Shakespeare at the end when he's been deposed and he's musing about all the time. And he just says, he's thinking about death and he says, "But whate'er I be, nor I, nor any man that but man is, with nothing shall be pleased till he be eased with being nothing."
Wow.
Give me a fucking break, right?
Yes, absolutely. Now, people might not want to see it, but damn it, I certainly would love to play.
That's a play I'm dying to direct, actually.
I would love to play that.
Well, I want to play Margaret in every way, shape, or form, so.
Yes, and I would love to play Prospero, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
would love to play as well. Yeah, those are two like that I have my eye on, like, now if anybody's doing it in, you know, in the next couple of years, because it seems like we won't be on stage for a while.
I directed The Tempest last year. I wish I'd had you.
Oh, me too. Oh,
yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, what else? There's some others, but those are the two that come to mind. I mean, of course.
Female Shakespeare roles you'd like to play, if you could?
If I could, any female roles? Well, I would just love to just be old Crazy Margaret.
Who wouldn't?
I would love to be Margaret.
In Richard III? Yeah. She's
Yes. Yeah. That's just fun. That's just good old fun. And I will tell you what I would love to play. Oh, another role that I'm dying to play. And someone needs to direct this play and put me in it now. Angelo in Measure for Measure.
Yeah.
God damn it. Stop naming plays that I directed a couple of years ago that I wish I'd had you for.
Angelo in Measure for Measure. I'm all over Angelo. But speaking of that, I'd love to play Isabella.
What about Isabella Speaks to You?
Well, it's funny. I did it once, actually, as a reading where we switched the roles. This was in New York some years ago. And I just really fell in love with Isabella. I thought that she was so strong. And I thought that she was really the person that the play is moving and turning on. And that last moment, you know, when the Duke, you know, comes to her, when everything's been revealed, and it's like, you know, come to me. It's like, does she go? Does she not go? How does she go? I was like, this is a really strong character, and she's so pure. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And the fact that she says absolutely nothing after the Duke announces they're going to get married.
Yeah, I love that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, like, what do you do? What do you do? And I don't know what I would. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there was a production, I think it was at the Donmore Warehouse in London a couple of years ago, that I wish I had seen, where I read about it, but I didn't see it. They cast the Angelo and the Isabella, like, switched roles, but not like but during performances.
What?
So, yeah,
I would love to do that.
So, like, sometimes the Angelo was sometimes the male actor was Angelo, and sometimes he was Isabella, and vice versa throughout the production. I'm not sure exactly how it worked because I didn't see it, but I was fascinated by that.
Oh my gosh. Their scenes together are just redonkulous.
Oh, I love that play.
Yeah, it's a good one, right? It's a trouble play, though, isn't it?
Very difficult play, but I love it, love it, love it.
I do too.
Some of the language in it is incredible, and some of the interactions back and forth are just on fire.
Absolutely. That Duke, though, he talks a lot. A lot. But between Isabella and Claudio and Isabella and Angelo, it's just, oof, amazing. Yes. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So this is an interesting question. Owen and I were talking about Othello, and assuming that Othello was played by an actor of color, right? What would you think about casting the role of Desdemona with a Black actress, like trying to be colorblind?
I think with Othello, I don't think it works. I think because in Othello, that's what the story of Othello is about, race.
Mm-hmm.
Well, right. For them, it's about what, nationality maybe, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But it really is, it's really about color. The story of Othello is, you know, it hinges on that. The whole first part of the play, right, is, I mean, in Othello's long monologue, I mean, you know, at the beginning, is about him being a person of color and, you know, him charming, or, you know, wooing, well, he says woo, they say bewitched, but wooing Desdemona, you know, wooing this young, innocent, pure, you know, all those things that go with being a white woman, you know what I'm saying? Just kind of like
stereotypically, yeah.
Stereotypically, exactly. So, I mean, I don't think that would work.
We don't either.
Yeah, we were just talking about it and trying to push the limits of colorblind casting. Because we were talking about it too, because I agree with you. It's a play about color and race. It's a play about otherness, right?
Otherness, yeah.
There you go.
And so if there if there's like to like rather than otherness, then I think it makes it's confusing for the audience. Again, there was a production, I didn't see it. I think this was at the Folger like years ago. Patrick Stewart played Othello, not in blackface. They called it White Othello. And it was Patrick Stewart as Othello and everyone else in the cast was black.
Yeah, it was a Shakespeare theater.
Shakespeare theater.
It was right. A Shakespeare theater.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I would have loved to have seen that.
So curious, too. Right? I mean,
but I mean, yes, they switched it, but the nature of the play is that I don't think it has the same effect when it's a white man.
No,
I don't think so either. Although I think that's about the only way you could possibly have a white actor play Othello these days.
Yeah. Obviously.
Absolutely.
I mean, my God, it took how long before there was an actual like actor of color who played Othello in major venues? I think it was not until like the 70s.
Right.
That's, I mean, go back and look at the Olivier film sometime. It's very cringy.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that was as late as 1965, and it was still considered just completely normal. And of course, it still happens in the opera.
That's right.
Right. Absolutely. We still have so far to go.
Indeed.
Still have so far to go. But you're right. You know, I think some certain plays and certain stories, I mean, that's the story. If the story is about that, then we need to see that. And especially in America, right? Especially in America, where the idea of color is so embedded in the foundation of who we are here. I mean, maybe it would play differently, you know what I mean? Like in Australia or, you know, in, you know, some other place. But in America, I just know, even as an African-American, like just, you know, like, where are you setting this play? And, you know, Kenya, you would be setting this play in, you know what I mean? In the Congo or something for Patrick Stewart to be Othello and everyone else is going to be, you know, black. We have to really, really suspend our disbelief a lot in this country for something like Othello to, you know, for us to flip the color on
right.
That.
And like we were saying, you know, we would accept, you know, we agree that either one of us would accept a black actor playing Shylock as long as the character was Jewish, because that play is about religion.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Well, it's about, it's about, I think it, both of them come down to being about otherness, but but certainly Shylock's Jewishness is essential to that play. So I don't personally care if a woman or a Martian or whoever plays Shylock, as long as Shylock himself is Jewish.
Right.
Right. Well, and the thing that's maybe different there, and tell me, with Othello, with Aaron, with like the Prince of Morocco, like they specifically talk about the characters talk about the color of, you know, of the Prince of Morocco's skin, of Othello's skin. They make reference to it. And as far as Shylock, you know, is concerned, they don't necessarily say, if I'm not mistaken, they don't say he's white. They may talk about other features.
Right. No.
Right. They talk about a hook nose, but they never talk about the color of his skin.
But they don't talk about the color of his skin. Exactly. So I'm with you. I'm with you. I would love, I've never seen that actually. A person of color playing Shylock. That's interesting.
Neither have I, but it would, that could potentially lend a really interesting element into that play.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
With the, obviously always assuming that the actor in question is brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, Shylock. Well, and then, okay, and then, so, right. So then we go there, right? I'm so not down for this. I mean, I guess you can try stuff for the hell of trying it, but if you're going to go out there like that, you know what I mean? And make those kind of statements, which can really, that will be lasting, you know, productions, you know what I mean? People will talk about those productions. I think that you have to get the best people that you can possibly get. And if you don't have the actors that are up to the challenge, you know, up to the task of playing it, then you just need to wait. Like I've seen some productions of, or heard of particular productions of Shakespeare plays where, you know, an African-American is playing blah, 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 just because, you know, the theater's trying to do something. It's like, but who is playing that part? you know, and the reviews of it are horrible. And, you know, the person that's, I don't know.
No, I get it. I mean, if you're going to do, you know, if you're going to make, if you're going to cast a Black Shylock, then let it be Denzel Washington. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think everybody would generally agree that that excellence is the bar for any production that you're trying to put together. And if you have, I mean, if you happen to have, you might go out and look for an African-American or any or Latino or Asian or American or whatever to play Shylock or what have you. But if you can't find that person and you're really committed to doing a really ethnically diverse production, then as you say, you have to either find the person or not do it.
Or just not do it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to do a Hamlet unless you have somebody that can do Hamlet.
Right. Right. Well, we would,
although you none of us would be surprised because we've all seen him. I mean, and this is of course why people think they hate Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because they're drag kicking, they're drag kicking and screaming, and then it's bad.
Yeah.
And so it only reinforces their prejudice. So it, and
they're forced to read it in school, and it's like learning another language.
Right. And who cares? It doesn't matter. Like it, in that sense, it doesn't matter a damn like whether what the casting is in terms of gender or ethnicity. Because if the play sucks, then the people that see it won't ever want to see any more Shakespeare.
Absolutely. Right. You just shot yourself in the foot, right? Yeah. And ruined it for a lot of other people as well. You're completely right. I will tell you, it's very interesting on that note. It's not Shakespeare, but Christmas Carol, which can be classical, I guess, considered classical in particular.
It's Dickens.
Right. It's Dickens. And there was a particular theater that I worked for that wanted a person of color to play Bob Cratchit. They wanted to diversify their Christmas Carol, right? And they wanted, you know, a Black Bob Cratchit, and they wanted Mrs. Cratchit to be Black as well. But there were no Black children. All of our children were white.
Well, I have to tell you,
at
Pittsburgh CLO, where I play Mrs. Cratchit, you know, in the 10 years that I've done it, I'm a white actress. I was Mrs. Cratchit. The Bob Cratchit was white, but our children are of all races.
But at least they're of all races.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like that.
Yeah.
I think when you have Black and white, it's such. We have to do so much work as an audience. You know, when we're just presented with Black, white, you know, Black, white.
Right.
It's like, that's what I think. Like, I can totally see, like, the children. That's great that the children were, you know, of all different from everywhere. I can buy that. You know what I mean? But if your parents are Black and all of your children are white.
Yeah, at least get one Black kid in there.
I mean, somebody, can we get, you know, can we get a biracial, I mean, you know, something, but it's just so much work. It's just,
you know, so Mrs. Cratchit's been having an affair.
Okay.
A lot, Mama's apparently. Baby.
Well, Bob's always working.
And he's so nice, that Bob Cratchit. He's just a pushover, isn't he? You know who wears the pants in that family? But yeah, so I mean, that's one of those, once again, and it's no fault of ours. It's just, you know, the hand that we've been dealt as Americans, you know, that like Black, whites, Romeo and Juliet, Black, white. If I see Black, white, you know, Montague and Capulet, then I'm putting some stuff on it that wasn't really, you know, there. They're two households, both alike in dignity. Right, and dignity. So they have the same amount of rights.
Yeah, if you're gonna do colorblind casting, and I mean, I have no problem at all with a you know, African American Romeo and a white Juliet or vice versa, but don't make the houses of Capulet and Montague all one thing,
it becomes West Side Story.
Exactly, and you know that's fine, but that's West Side Story.
Right.
Romeo and Juliet, I mean, to me, the best way to do it is to just, it doesn't matter, whoever the best actors are, get cast, and if they're different, I mean, that's how colorblind casting should work. And so, right. if, you know, if Prince Aeschylus is black and Romeo is Latino and Juliet is Asian, I mean, you know, and there's some white people around too.
Great.
That's fine. But I get why people do the black white thing for Capulet Montague. I mean, I think it's easier to just have them color coded in terms, not ethnically, but costume wise.
Right.
Absolutely.
All the Capulets are red. All the Montagues are blue.
Right, or shades of red and shades of blue, if you right. really want it to make. And then the Aeschylus people are gold or some shit.
Purple, they're royal.
There you go. Owen, I don't know this. Maybe you know the history behind that actual choice. You know what I mean? And I wonder if that choice of one house is of color and the other house is white. Came or started because of us trying to be more inclusive of the theater, trying to be more inclusive and trying to get more people of color on stage. And that being, and having one family as black and the other one as white was maybe the only way that they could see that people would, that it could be palatable maybe to.
I don't know the history of it, but I'm willing to bet that you're right. And I'm also, actually, I think Lisa Ann touched on it as well. I think the popularity of West Side Story had something to do with it.
I agree.
Quite frankly.
And then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then yes, people increasingly since the 60s have wanted to get a little more, woke and a little more progressive and have started to try to diversify casting. And that's an easy solution.
There you go.
I think it's frankly kind of a lazy solution in that play. But it's easy.
Well, there was a production of the Tempest that was cast with all women of color. There was a female Prospero and it was cast with all women of color, which I'm all about, but I saw that production. If you're casting them because of their skin color and not because of their artistry and their talent, that's a problem.
It's a huge problem.
In both directions.
And it's I think it was the late 80s, I saw a production at the Public of Midsummer Night's Dream, which is another easy play to do, just as you were saying before. And the fairies were all black. The mechanicals were Latino, except F. Murray Abraham was bottom. And the court, the lovers and Theseus and Hippolyta were white. And,
that's
horrible.
I mean,
but I have to say it was actually a really good production. I'm sorry to say, but again, that's sort of a lazy way to have a diverse cast.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope they didn't consider themselves color. I mean, I hope they didn't consider that colorblind casting.
Because it clearly wasn't.
You can consider a colorblind casting when you're casting somebody specifically for the color of their skin.
No, that's the opposite of color.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow, that was a stimulating conversation.
Right. You put the button on that one, Lisa.
Alvin, we're going to have you back.
Alvin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor to have this conversation with you.
For sure.
I feel the same way. Hey, once again, thank you all so much. I love you both. Owen, I'm so glad that we finally got a chance to meet and
actually
work together, even though it's just been on Zoom and reading.
Two of my favorite people in the whole world meeting up together and loving each other. Yay!
Lisa brings people together. She does. And she's talked about you for years, Owen. So I was very, very excited and happy when you all started your Shakespeare series this summer and you all asked me to be a part of it. So,
well, us too, and we're thrilled to have you as a part of Shakespeare Sunday and now part of the Bardcast.
That's right, and our very first guest, which is super exciting. So thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us today and talking to our dear friend, Alvin. Again, you can always email us at thebardcastyoudick@gmail.com if you want to continue this conversation with us. And please don't forget to check out our website at www.thebardcastyoudick.com. You have to tell them about patreon.com first.
Oh, I usually do the other one. Sorry.
I know.
The things are tight these days, but if you have a little spare change that you'd like to throw our way, you can send it to us via our Patreon page on our website. And also, please be sure to click the button for the Actors Fund. It's the charity that the podcast supports. And it's really important in this time. A lot of artists are suffering. So please do.
Okay, and now I want all three of us to go and remember. It's Shakespeare, you dick, on the count of three. Ready? One, two, three.
And remember, it's Shakespeare, you dick.
That was terrible. Oh my God.
It's really hard to do. It's surprisingly hard to do.
It's like singing on Zoom. You can't do it.
I know.
Just,
I know.
No, no.
The preceding podcast was a production of Country Matters, LLC, copyright 2020, all rights reserved.